From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm David Lazarus, and this is Marketplace Money from APM. Sequester. Maybe the only good thing you can say is that it's a heck of a Scrabble word. Our political leaders couldn't cut a budget deal, so the poison pill of spending cuts they deliberately designed to be too bitter to swallow is now stuck in our national throat. President Obama warned of dire consequences. Here are some choice cuts.
Thousands of teachers and educators will be laid off. Tens of thousands of parents will have to scramble to find childcare for their kids. Hundreds of thousands of Americans will lose access to primary care and preventive care like flu vaccinations and cancer screenings.
Holy cow!
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Leave the politics of this mess to others. What Marketplace Money wants to know, as usual, is how this will affect ordinary people. We're not thinking about aircraft carriers and corporate profits, although those are important too. We're thinking about retirement funds and credit card rates. And what will all this uncertainty do to the economic recovery? Bottom line, how much doom and gloom do we really need to be ready for? So let's find out just how much sequester Prozac we're going to need. And to advise us, we're joined by economist and author Julianne Malveaux. Welcome.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
So when we all get to work on Monday, not to be too Chicken Little about this, will we find that the sky has fallen?
No, the sky doesn't fall on Monday. The sky probably falls on March 27th when we go again to see whether we'll close government. In the meantime, I think we've already seen the effect of sequester on consumers. Spending at Walmart went down. Now, Walmart is where you can get the cheapest stuff. So it suggests that even working class people are being very careful about what they're spending. And we know that spending is what drives the market.
Right, but you're being all macro about this. Let's get micro. In other words, what's in it for me? Is this going to affect my retirement plan, interest rates, my ability to get a loan? I mean, what's the deal?
So first of all, here's what happens to you, ordinary consumer. If you work for the federal government, you're going to have less money in your pocket. If you work for somebody who supports the federal government, say the restaurant around the corner from the Treasury Department, you're going to see fewer customers coming in. People are going to be cutting back. One of the stories that I found very interesting, I was in an airport last week, and the line was a bit longer than usual. I sort of grumbled a little bit, and the woman who was checking me in said, well, you know, if we have the sequester, you're going to have to wait even longer. Now, again, that's not going to happen in March. It'll happen in April. And so we're going into the busy summer season for travel, and you can expect people to stand in lines a bit longer. Now, I can't say how much longer, but they're already talking about some smaller airports possibly being closed. Now, some people say these are scare tactics, but I'm not sure if you're asking for cuts across the board, that TSA won't be one of those cut.
Quick reminder to everyone playing along at home, the United States boasts the largest economy in the world. So, Dr. Malveaux, should I be concerned that I'm expected to balance my checkbook and maintain good finances, and yet Uncle Sam turns to what seems to be a bunch of sixth graders to be running the economy?
I love that, sixth graders. Well, one of the other issues about sequester and taking roughly 6% out of our budget is that it will cause recession. I mean, that's unquestionable. Austerity has not worked in Europe, and it's not going to work in the United States. And our economy is sitting on this precipice of recovery and going back down to recession. And so if we have recession, we have world recession. Now, for you personally, we should always maintain the best personal finances that we can. Using your credit card to pay for your lunch, unless you can pay it back at the end of the month, is a really bad idea. You want to spend 20% interest on lunch. So that's one of the things that people need to think about. How much do I owe? Do I have a plan to pay it back? And that's the same thing that the International Monetary Fund has asked the United States to do. They're not saying that we have to sequester. They're saying come up with a plan. And what we have is a monthly emergency. I think the American people are getting tired of an emergency a month. Well, the emergency of the month club.
So as of this moment, the sky hasn't fallen, but I got a little less headroom.
The sky hasn't fallen, but it might fall in April. And certainly, if they can't agree on a budget, we'll see government close down. Only essential employees will be kept on. And so we know how that's going to play in terms of things that we ask our government to do as citizens.
Economist and author Dr. Julianne Malveaux, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you have it. The sequester will be a mixed bag for American families. Some will wait to see what happens. Some have been bracing for this moment to avoid another in a series of financial body blows. Linda Harlow of York, Pennsylvania, believes she and her husband will survive the sequester, but not without a struggle.
My name is Linda Harlow, and my husband is a civilian employee, an engineer working for the United States Army. My husband's job is going to be affected by the sequester, essentially a 20% pay cut for him. He will be forced to work a four-day week with the same workload, but it'll only be 4 days. My grocery bill's not getting cut by 20%. My utilities aren't being cut by 20%. I'm laid off right now. I do have another job starting, but it doesn't start until March the 6th. So I have to file for unemployment again. Unemployment benefits are also going to be cut by 10% with this sequester. Retirement for me is not an option at this time. I am 61 years old. I mean, I previously had to dip into my 401k savings last year. I'm having to do it again. I have had to, unfortunately, you know, charge my groceries when there wasn't enough cash to do that. I hate doing it. Hate doing utility bills on the credit card. But, you know, you have to do what you do. My husband and I share different political views. So consequently, it generally ends up in an argument of some sort. But for the most part, we both agree that everyone needs to get rid of their own personal agendas and just work together. We elected them. We hired them. They work for us, and they're not doing their job properly.
Thanks much to Linda Harlow of York, Pennsylvania. Just across the border in PG County, Maryland, Erica Towns is planning her own sequester survival strategy. She works as a civilian nurse at Andrews Air Force Base. Government cuts will force her to take 22 days of unpaid leave. She invited us to talk about it over the dinner table.
Let's all have a round of peanut butter and jellies tonight.
No, can we?
I didn't create that problem. The Nimrods and nitwits that did in Congress, they're the one that created the problem. So if you created the problem, you should be one trimming the fat, not me.
Yeah.
And what's your dinner wish list, Aaron?
Chicken nuggets and fries.
Wrong. Am I going to have to borrow from someone else? Maybe. Am I going to take out a loan? Could be. Am I going to just kind of wing it and put a little something here, put a little something here, put a little something here? Maybe I'll do that. They're playing this tug of war and I'm the flag. You know, no, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. And we're just little pawns on a chessboard. And it's just, it's every time I turn around, it's something major and something catastrophic from Congress.
How is the sequester affecting you? You can tell us your story at marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. This week, Apple agreed to settle a class action lawsuit filed by peeved parents. They're complaining that their kids racked up big bills on mobile device games that appeared to be free and weren't, and that Apple made it way too easy to get into trouble. The problem involves so-called in-app purchases. That's when you're playing a game and you spend a little money to get a bigger sword, a better house, bonus points. Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
A couple of years ago, Brent Goldberg's two young sons downloaded Dolphin Play, a free game on their iPod Touch. In the game, you raise dolphins and other fish in a tank. There are also spending opportunities.
And you would get these coins and you would exchange them for virtual fish.
In the case of Goldberg's seven-year-old, $50 worth of virtual fish.
And I found out 2 hours later when the credit card company called and said I had some weird charges coming through. I'm like, oh, where's it from? And they're like, oh, it's from Apple. I'm like, boys, what are you doing?
That cry has echoed through houses across the country, roughly 23 million houses in the case of this Apple settlement. Moms and dads say Apple did not put enough parental controls in place on free app games and made it too easy for young kids to unknowingly spend their parents' money. parents like Mike Bertrand.
The kids were very surprised to learn that they were spending real money and very confused about it.
Bertrand's three young kids started playing a free iPad game called Tapfish.
It's a little virtual aquarium, but if you want to buy different tanks, if you want to buy little castles or little fish, you have to use what appears to be play money.
It's not play money. Bertrand realized what was going on when he noticed an email receipt from the iTunes store for $150.
I started going through some other ones that had been trapped in my spam folder and found that over the course of about a week, my kids had tallied about $1,500 on the game.
Apple reimbursed both Mike Bertrand and Brent Goldberg. They didn't join the class action suit. In agreeing to settle the case, Apple will give many parents a $5 iTunes gift card. Those whose kids' fishy charges topped $30 will get cash refunds. The settlement adds up to around $100 million.
The question is whether this is a deceptive practice.
Colby Zintel is with advocacy group Common Sense Media. She applauds the settlement and points out Apple has put some barriers in place to stop this from happening. There's now a setting on iPhones, iPads, and other devices that requires a password before you can spend real money inside of a game or app. Still, Zintel takes issue with some of the free games aimed at children.
The ability to press a button and move to a next level and you're charging your parents' credit cards, you have to question what the business practices are.
Those business practices grew out of the app marketplace, says Renee Ritchie of tech news site iMore.
When the App Store originally launched in 2008, there were apps like Super Monkey Ball, and that was a $10 app.
But Ritchie says nobody wanted to pay that much for an iPhone game.
And this model emerged called freemium.
Freemium means the game itself is free, but things inside the game cost money.
Instead of having to earn something in a game, you can just buy it.
Betting on impatience paid off. Ritchie says all of the top-grossing games right now are free-ish, and they'll stay free if Mike Bertrand has anything to say about it.
Well, my kids don't know my iTunes password anymore.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Later in the show, some can only dream of moving from a poor neighborhood to a middle-class community. But for those who do make it, the transition can be tough.
Have you met some of your neighbors?
No. The first tendency is to say, well, you know, I'm just going to keep to myself. But, you know, that's not going to feel good for you. And you might have a lot that that community could benefit from.
That story coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. There are very few areas nationwide growing as fast as Houston. Yeehaw! The city was recently named the healthiest housing market for 2013 by Trulia. That's a real estate listing company. Houston is home to companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron, attracting tons of people to the area for jobs. But can the good times keep rolling in the capital of black gold and Texas tea? Ty Clam certainly hopes so. He's a broker for RE/MAX 360 in Houston. Ty, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
All right. So, Mr. Klom, help me out here. When I think about Houston, I'm thinking about oil. I'm thinking about NASA. Maybe I'm thinking about some guns. But that makes me kind of old school. If I wanted to buy some property in Houston now, what am I looking at?
The economic landscape of Houston is really diverse. We have financial sectors along with the things that you think about, oil, gas, and the Port of Houston. And we have tons of jobs relocating here. I think Forbes rated us as the number fourth best city in terms of job creation. And so if you're looking for purchasing homes in the Houston area, inventory is scarce as it is across the nation. We have such a diverse housing market that has been completely booming with the lack of new construction and pent-up demands to buy. So you're seeing a lot of rental properties coming up. You're seeing a lot of new apartment complexes being developed to accommodate the buyer pool that is unable to buy. And currently right now, it's a seller's market. And it's shifted like that within the past, I'd probably say 12 months. And buyers have to be educated in expectation to either submit a full price offer or compete against other buyers that are possibly out there.
Here in LA, if I wanted to buy a three-bedroom house, especially one in a decent school district, I'm looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars in outlay. If I wanted the same sort of thing in Houston, what's it going to cost me?
Oh, it's very affordable. The average price of a home right now is about $172,000 is what you're looking at. And median family price is about $243,000. So the cost of living is very inexpensive in comparison to L.A. and New York and other markets like that.
So if I'm paying $170,000 or so for a three-bedroom house, how does that compare to past years?
It's up. The same time last year, you're looking at about $160,000 for that same price. So we're looking at almost an 8% appreciation over a year.
That's a good investment.
It's a great investment and great opportunity. And now with where interest rates are, you can actually buy more home than you could in the previous years.
So tell me, who's buying exactly? I mean, if I've got a house there, who's moving in next door?
Oh, boy, you've got several types of buyer pools that are out there. You have the Generation X and Y and millennials coming to the market. That's about 84 million consumers altogether. And then the baby boomers, you're seeing a lot of downsizing occur as well.
Now, I thought all the hipsters were moving into Austin. Is Houston also attracting its share of the hip and cool crowd?
You know, I went to school at UT, so I know how weird Austin can be. But in terms of the weird crowd, I wouldn't say so. What I would call weird was the subprime market when unqualified borrowers were able to purchase at that time. Here we have qualified borrowers with great credit, putting, you know, substantial amounts of money down, being able to qualify for today's mortgage criteria that are out there.
Well, what about the outlying areas? Like, I've always had this fantasy about Marfa, where they filmed the George Stevens movie Giant. What if I were to go all the way out in the sticks and go buy something in Marfa? I would get a huge deal, right?
You know, you would be absolutely surprised that there's not that much inventory that's out there. For the outlying areas of Houston, you consider areas like Woodlands. That's, you know, 45 minutes from the central area of Houston. There's economic booms with Shell and Exxon campus relocating there that have tremendously appreciated the value of the area.
What's the most expensive home you've ever sold?
$1.85 million.
In L.A., that's nothing.
That's a starter home in L.A.
What will $1.85 million get me in Houston?
10,000 square feet, 6 bedrooms, 7 baths, and a nice pool.
Get out of town! I've heard about families that have had to write practically love letters to the sellers talking about how enamored they are with the house. I've heard about buyers that actually bring cookies over to give to the seller. Are there any little tips you would give to Houston buyers?
You know, going that extra step, it doesn't hurt developing an emotional connection with the homeowner for them to be able to convey the purchase to the buyer. It's not unheard of. My recommendation is identify the property that you want and don't be afraid to go ahead and submit it at what the homeowner's asking for.
And don't skimp on the cookies.
And don't skimp on the cookies. Absolutely right.
Ty Klom is a broker for RE/MAX 360 in Houston, Texas. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, Buckaroos, this is Marketplace Money from APM. So let's decamp from sunny Houston and bask in the bigger picture. And to help us, we're joined by our buddy Glenn Kelman. He's CEO of the online real estate brokerage Redfin. Hey, Glenn.
Good to be back, David.
You know, if there's one element to all of these stops to these real estate markets that we've been doing here on the program, it's one of recovery. I'm hearing that markets across the nation are coming back for various reasons. Is that a fair read of things?
I think it is a fair read of things. Even markets where we'd written them off for 2012 are suddenly strong again. Chicago has always been such a stable market, but now it's got bidding wars all over the city. Atlanta was a market that had been left behind in 2012, but now demand is roaring there. So we're seeing the recovery really broaden to places that it hadn't been to before.
What's interesting, too, is that the demand for housing seems to be coming from different quarters. For instance, in the Houston bit we just heard, families are looking for homes to settle down in. And yet a week or two ago, we heard from Florida where we were looking at investors getting into the market, trying to find homes that they could flip or do something else with. It seems as though demand to get in is broad-based, and that must be lighting a fire under the entire market.
Absolutely. I would say that some of the investors have actually left the building because they can't make money as the prices increase. So there are so many bidding wars that Wall Street has taken a step back and Main Street has really stepped in. Those are the folks who are buying homes now. And it's probably going to be a much more sustainable recovery because of that. We've seen household formation really increase over the past year. There were lots of people living in mom's basement who are now ready to get their own place.
Tell me how interest rates play into this. They're at near historically low levels. Are we expecting them to stay there? And is that going to fuel the recovery?
Well, at least for the short term, they're going to stay there because the Federal Reserve has really made a commitment to keep rates low to make sure the economy continues to chug along. But long term, I don't know if they can last. That's beyond my powers of foresight. So it's definitely driving demand. Everybody knows that money is cheap, and they want to get in somewhere near the bottom of the market. One of the things that's really changed in the past few weeks has been that credit's gotten easier, too. For a long time, rates were low, especially last year, but it was hard for regular folks to be able to qualify for those loans. And now, as banks get more confident and their sales force gets more aggressive, we're seeing more aggressive lending practices, too, and that's just allowed folks who couldn't qualify last year to qualify now.
We're speaking with Glenn Kelman. He's CEO of Redfin. That's a real estate software company. Glenn, stick around because I want to bring in some of our listeners and talk a little bit more about our theme du jour, and that is real estate. And our first caller is Rita, calling from Jones Creek, Texas. Hi, Rita.
Hi.
Jones Creek, Texas. Where's that?
It's kind of below Houston. It's on the coast near Freeport.
When I hear a name like Jones Creek, I'm thinking kind of Little House on the Prairie. I'm guessing not.
It's a small community, yes.
Okay, so what's your question?
Well, I went and refinanced my house, or I tried to. I started in October, and I'm still waiting for them to close. And I had contacted Marketplace because I actually heard one of the CEOs from Wells Fargo talk about how wonderful they're doing and how well they're doing with their consumers and working with them. And I was like, I don't think so. So that's why I contacted y'all.
Is Wells Fargo your lender in this case?
Yes, they are. And I've had them for years, and I wanted to refinance and take out some equity. And they want so much documentation. I'm like, I've had my mortgage with y'all for years.
For everybody playing along at home, a few weeks back, we had a senior mortgage official from Wells Fargo on to talk about what the bank was looking for in a refi or a loan mod application. He gave the real impression that these guys were a willing partner. And I'll tell you, judging from a lot of the comments I saw at MarketplaceMoney.org, as well as you, Rita, I've heard from a lot of people who said, not me. So your experience with Wells is then what? They're dragging their feet because you said they did approve the refi, no?
Yes, they approved it. I guess like almost a month ago, but they had told me you'd be closing by no later than December. Then they said January. Then they said February. And I'm like, it's well worth what I'm asking you. I mean, it's over what it's well. I'm only asking for like a total of 60, and it appraised at 150 in its current condition. So I don't know what they're doing. It's just I can't get a straight answer. It's I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, I went with them because they had my mortgage, and I thought it would be easier. And now I'm thinking, you know, this is 4 or 5 months. This has not been easier.
Glenn Kelman of Redfin. This is a story I've heard time and time again. How do you appraise this situation?
Well, I'm not a shill for the banks, but usually Wells Fargo is one of the easier banks for us to deal with. But I think there are two factors militating against a speedy approval. Number one, you're in Texas and you're trying to take cash out. For whatever reason in that state, cash out loans require a special kind of voodoo. It's very difficult to do. And then the other is that you tried to get the money on October. That's when rates were at an absolute historic low and every loan officer was inundated across the country. But having said all that, it's unacceptable. You should not have to wait 4 months. The typical amount of time required is 2 months. And if you're buying a house, it's usually 1 month. So I would try to talk to the folks who work with that loan officer, his boss, her boss, someone in management in that office to try to understand exactly what's taking so long and just have them document everything that they need to close the loan. At this point, you should have a really simple scratch list of what needs to happen for the loan to close.
Glenn, let me ask you this. Does it make sense for Rita to go to a different bank at this point?
I would. I mean, I'd have a direct conversation with Wells Fargo, but if you've got a loan officer you can't get on the phone and who can't explain the process to you and you don't have any confidence that the closing's going to happen in a few days, at that point, I would talk to other folks and just understand their process. Wells may not be motivated because rates have risen since then, and I think if you talk to somebody else now, you would probably lose a little bit on the rate. So I would talk to other folks just to give yourself some leverage, but hope that Wells comes through because you've come this far with them and you probably got a better rate than you could get if you started today.
All right. Well, let us know what happens. Also, I got to know, what are you, the Partridge Family there? What are all those kids I hear in the background?
I teach kindergarten.
Ah, okay.
Well, yeah.
Today's lesson, boys and girls, how to refi your mortgage.
Right.
All right, Rita, please keep us posted on what happens. And any of our friends at Wells Fargo who are listening, come on, guys, get your heads out of the sand and do something here. Rita, thanks so much for the call. I want to turn now to Dave calling from Kirkland, Washington. Hiya, Dave.
Hi.
So what's going on with you? What do you do?
I work for a consulting firm, and we design water projects, everything from dams to pipes to water treatment plants to, you know, fish ladders and anything in between.
Fish ladders. That's a great thing to have on your resume. Well, I make fish ladders. You know, there it is. Okay. Well, what's your question for us?
Well, my wife and I closed on our loan for our house at the end of 2011. We have pretty good credit. We're able to get a pretty good interest rate, but, you know, as you were saying previously, I mean, the interest rates keep on getting lower, and it looks like they may continue to do so. I've been kind of following along as time's gone on, and at this point, you know, I'm thinking about actually refinancing our loan if the rate was good enough. And I've kind of checked around with our current lender, which is Wells Fargo, and also I've kind of done some research online at bankrate.com. You know, the cheapest or best rates that I've been able to find tend to be through either smaller banks or like non-traditional lenders, like through credit card companies. At least this is what I've been able to find online. Are there any risks with refinancing through one of these types of lenders?
Glenn Kelman of Redfin, let's try and tackle these right now. So when you go to a mortgage broker and he or she trundles out some lower interest rate loans from places you've never heard of, is that a red flag?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you have to be careful about it, but I don't have any particular issue about working with a smaller lender rather than a bigger lender. Sometimes you get better service. Sometimes they understand what properties are really worth in your neighborhood, so you have fewer appraisal issues. So that can be a good move. The red flag for me is I think it's hard to compare a quote you get over the internet with a quote that you get from a loan officer for a couple of reasons. First of all, people really need to understand everything about your situation, whether it's going to be a conforming loan, whether you're going to be able to put 20% down, what your credit score is. And sometimes when you read about national rates or you check the internet, you get a national average that doesn't include all the costs that you have to pay to get that rate. So sometimes you're buying that rate by paying 1% of the loan amount just to get a lower rate, which can make sense if you stay in the place for a long time, but doesn't make sense if you're only going to be in the loan for a few years. The best rate, the lowest closing costs, the fewest points, these are things that really matter. But the name of the bank that you're getting it from, I could care less. So what I would do if I were Dave is call three loan officers on the same day, because rates change from day to day, and get quotes based on the information that they provide. And they should be able to do that without having to pull your credit. You know, if they pull your credit over and over and over again, it can actually affect your credit and limit your ability to get a low rate. I would just have them take on faith that you have a score of 730 or 750 or 680 or whatever it might be, and then give you a quote and try to hold them to that. And what you really want to understand is not just the interest rate, but all the other costs that are associated with it. Because the problem you have when buying a loan is that it's very hard to get an apples to apples to apples comparison. And that's what you really want.
Well, Dave, let me tell you what happened to me. I went shopping for a refi recently, and I also have my mortgage at a major bank like yours. And when the loans came up from a mortgage broker, they were all places I'd never heard of. One of the factors, though, was that because of my mortgage at this major bank, I get perks from that because I have a higher level of business with the bank. Thus, I get free checking. Thus, I get a free safe deposit box. I get things like that that maybe aren't deal breakers, but they're important to me. So you said that you've got your mortgage at Wells Fargo. Do you do your other banking at Wells as well?
Yes, we do.
If I went to a smaller no-name lender, no name I say because I'd never heard of them before, yeah, I could have gotten a lower rate, but I needed to balance that against the convenience element. How important is that for you?
I would say the convenience element is pretty important. We do like having our checking and our mortgage go through the same spot.
All right. So when you go shopping around for a refi, that's definitely something you want to do as well. Call up Wells, explain the terrain to them, and ask what would happen in just a worst case scenario if I were to take my mortgage somewhere else, what happens to the rest of my retail banking endeavors? And just make sure. And that's not to say you definitely don't want to go anywhere else because you just might. But it's good to know all of the moving parts in an equation like this. You buy that?
Yeah. Is there any chance you could get a quote from another bank and then go back to Wells Fargo and ask them to try to match that rate?
Dave, you read my mind. That's exactly what I would do. Even if you know you're going to go with Wells, I would check with two other banks on the same day that you got a quote from Wells and then just let your loan officer at Wells know that this is the deal somebody else offered you. And if you've got more than just an internet quote, if you've got something based on a deeper understanding of your entire situation, I think that puts Wells in a position where they're much more likely to give you a better deal.
Make sure you get that other quote in writing, okay?
Okay.
All right, and keep us posted. Let us know. Either give us a call or post something at marketplacemoney.org. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thanks.
All right, and Glenn Kelman, one final word from you. The housing market, we're seeing general improvement. Do you see it continuing?
I do think it will continue, at least for a little while. I mean, what's happened in the market is that all the banks are no longer selling many properties. We've seen drastic declines of over 50% in distressed inventory. So the only folks who are selling houses now are regular conventional home sellers, and they want more money before they're willing to put their properties on the market. And that's just created a real squeeze where there's not enough houses for people to buy, and there are plenty of people who have lined up the credit who really want to take advantage of being somewhere near the bottom of the market. So that's driving a real asymmetry in the market. There's 2 or 3 months of demand in most of the markets we serve, and most home buyers are pretty frustrated, and most home sellers are still sitting on the sidelines waiting for prices to rise even more.
Glenn Kelman is CEO of Redfin. That's a real estate software company. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David. It was fun.
Just ahead, talking about money can be, well, downright unpleasant, but it doesn't have to be.
I see couples who are really, really skillful, smart people in every area of their lives seem to malfunction when it comes to money, and money is often the number one issue that they have disharmony and conflict around.
Ways to create financial intimacy with your significant other. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Where you lay your hat is your home. And it can have a big impact on your finances. So let's take a look at so-called residential mobility programs. These are government efforts to help low-income families move from neighborhoods that might be rife with poverty, struggling schools, few opportunities, to middle-class communities where it might be easier to get a leg up. But no matter what the economic payoff of such moves may be, putting down roots in a new neighborhood is seldom easy. Marketplace Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark talks to some families in Chicago who've made the journey.
Squirrels. If you've lived in a middle-class neighborhood for most of your life, you might take them and their scampering for granted. But squirrels are one of the first things that Valerie Love noticed about the neighborhood she and her 12-year-old daughter, Jada, moved to recently.
Hey, Jada, tell her about when I had the bag of jelly beans.
She was throwing jelly beans to the squirrels.
They was coming out from every direction.
Jada says their old neighborhood, it had a different kind of wildlife.
It had bugs.
And what about this place? Is it bug-free?
Yes.
Jada and her mom have invited me to their new apartment on the north side of Chicago in a neighborhood called Albany Park. Valerie is doing some home improvement right now, putting up a closet door. That's the hammering and drilling you hear in the background. In between power tools, Valerie and Jada tell me about some of the other differences between their old neighborhood and their new one. Their old one?
Bad, just killing.
Abandonments look like somebody took a grenade and blew up half the blocks.
But their new neighborhood, they say?
Peaceful. Clean.
There's no gangs hanging on the corner.
Squirrels. Peacefulness, those sorts of new experiences are welcome for Valerie and Jada, but there are other adjustments involved in their recent move that have been hard, uncomfortable. This becomes clear as Valerie gives me a tour of her apartment, past the kitchen that the landlord used as a big selling point.
It's a European-style kitchen, microwave over the stove and a stainless steel refrigerator. And then my room.
And then,
junkie.
Valerie gets self-conscious. She's taped plastic over the windows for extra insulation in the cold winters. But when her landlord visited today,
he said he don't like the plastic over the windows.
Same goes for the blanket with the face of a tiger that she's hung over the doorway to the guest room.
He came in here complaining about that. You got a rug over the door. I said, a blanket, sir, a blanket.
It's an unspoken thing, but even after 7 months in their new world, it's easy to feel judged by a landlord over decorating choices, by new neighbors.
So where are we now?
In the backyard. Everybody had grills on the porch.
Have you met some of your neighbors?
No. I don't socialize too much with the neighbors in the building.
You do feel like an outsider, I have.
Jacqueline Williams also recently moved through a residential mobility program to another middle-class neighborhood in Chicago's North Side. It's called Edgewater, and like the area where Valerie and Jada live, Williams says it doesn't have a lot of other Black residents.
The first tendency is to say, well, you know, I'm just going to keep to myself, but, you know, that's not going to feel good for you. And you might have a lot that that community could benefit from.
Williams says even though she feels like she sticks out for having subsidized rent, for being Black, she says she's trying to make connections in her new community.
I patronize the boutiques and the restaurants. I think the Alderman or something put on this annual Halloween type of thing, and it wasn't that many African Americans there. Now, I can't say that I have friends that I've developed there, but we got to meet people.
And it's just a packet. It's about a 10-page packet.
Tracy Robinson is a mobility counselor with a group called Housing Choice Partners in Chicago. She's helped Jackie Williams and people like her to move and adjust to their new neighborhoods. Robinson goes down a mental list of some of the common challenges her clients run into. One woman couldn't get used to how quiet her new neighborhood was. Another was worried about leaving behind the friends and family from her old neighborhood who helped out with babysitting. Though once she moved, she realized the trade-off was that in a safer neighborhood, her kids could do more stuff on their own.
Her grandchildren actually can ride the bus on their own now, and she's glad she made the move. She don't have to worry.
Robinson also has firsthand experience with moving from a poor neighborhood to a middle-class one. Her family went through a mobility program a few years ago, and she still remembers the rocky beginnings.
It was like almost a month went by, and we were getting a cold shoulder. You know, we were speaking, people wouldn't say anything.
She decided to tackle the problem head on.
Finally, I just went to one of the neighbors. I introduced myself, and I just let her know that if we had offended her in any way, you know, accept our apology. And that's when she went to tell me about how the parking went.
Turns out there was an unspoken rule on her new block that everybody got one parking spot in front of their own house. The Robinsons had been parking in front of other people's homes.
If somebody had came and said, you know what, welcome to the neighborhood, you know, we kind of let everybody park in front of their house, blah, 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 then we would have ran with that. But we didn't know.
Now the Robinsons do know because they asked. Tracy Robinson says it was a little thing, but it made it so much easier to feel comfortable. She's been friends with her neighbors ever since.
And Marketplace Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark joins me now in the studio. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, David.
So the Robinsons seem to have made a reasonable adjustment to their new climate. Does everybody do as well?
Well, it turns out that there are actually a lot of families who end up feeling so unwelcome in these neighborhoods that they move back to their old ones or to ones with similar issues. There was a nationwide study that was done with a bunch of these programs a few years ago, and it turned out that almost 30% of the families who had initially moved to suburbs or middle-class neighborhoods moved back.
Even though what they're going back to might be the rough stuff.
Right, right. But they felt either unwelcome or discriminated against or just missed the networks that they had, those family networks, and they felt more familiar in the kinds of places that they had grown up in.
The Robinsons succeeded after they were able to reach out to their neighbors. What would you say to any prospective neighbors who are already out there who might, you know, find some new tenants in the building? What should they do?
Right. Well, a community is a two-way street. So if someone new moves into your neighborhood, maybe think about taking Tracy Robinson's advice. Introduce yourself. And of course, definitely, if you have unwritten parking rules, let everybody know about them.
And cookies and pie go a long way, too.
Definitely. I like blueberry.
Marketplace Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Moving to a new place can launch you on the road to prosperity, and hopefully you'll get there. But how do you know when you've arrived? Marketplace is on the move again, asking people to finish this sentence. You know you're wealthy when? And today, we're in Baltimore.
You know you're wealthy when you don't have to live paycheck to paycheck and you're comfortable with what you're making.
You know you're wealthy when you can afford your own home.
When you don't know what a gas bill looks like or any type of bill, no type of utilities or anything.
You know you're wealthy when you've been married for more than 25 years. That's right.
think you know you're wealthy when your friends tell you you're wealthy, or they laugh off any of your financial woes because they think that you have enough money and don't need to worry about them.
I believe you are wealthy when you go to bed and you stay 8 hours sleeping in a good shape.
Sure, you know you're wealthy when you bought a Roboco, and a Roboco is a fancy name for a food processor. Those are high-end kitchen items, so you'll know you're wealthy when you do that.
When you have everything that you need, not necessarily want, but that you need, I feel like you're a wealthy person.
Oh, yeah, you know you're wealthy when you have your husband and your children, your family around you.
You have a car, you're not catching the bus when you're wealthy, and you're not worried about when you're going to pay your next bill, how you're going to get your next check. That's how you know when you're wealthy.
What about you? How will you know when you're wealthy? Tweet us with the hashtag #YoureWealthyWhen. And to see photos of the people we just heard from and from others across the country and the world, go to marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. Money may not buy you love, but it can buy a lot of heartache. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Breakups, divorces, cash, or lack thereof, can cast a very dark cloud over many people's relationships. So, how do we restore that warm embrace of financial intimacy to our lives? To answer that question, we're joined by Deborah Price. She's a former financial advisor and now CEO and founder of the Money Coaching Institute. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, David.
Your new book is called The Heart of Money, A Couple's Guide to Creating True Financial Intimacy. Well, let's talk about that idea. When you say financial intimacy, I'm thinking you light some candles, you put on some Barry White, you talk about tax-free muni bonds. Is that accurate or do I have it wrong?
Really, financial intimacy is about learning how to communicate about money in a healthy way and fully disclose and be vulnerable and safe and not something that many couples actually feel.
But do people really get all fragile and vulnerable when they talk about money?
It's amazing how much emotion comes up when people speak about money. And often there are a lot of feelings that we don't express.
Where do those feelings come from?
From an early time in our lives, we begin to experience money mostly in the context of our parents. And unfortunately, money is such a taboo subject that when we hear or watch our parents, we often see that there's a lot of emotion, sensitivity, often even anger, stress, etc. So money patterns and behaviors become hardwired in the brain at early ages, and then we go out and express that conflict as adults.
Let's say you're growing up, you don't see your parents hugging and kissing a lot, so you have to teach yourself as you grow how to do those things. Well, how do you develop the money emotional skills that you're describing if your parents fought about money a lot, didn't talk about money? How do you attain those skills?
That's exactly the problem and why I started this field. I see couples who are really, really skillful, smart people in every area of their lives seem to malfunction when it comes to money, and money is often the number one issue that they have disharmony and conflict around. And therefore, the result is money is a common cause of divorce. So part of what we do is we teach people how to begin to navigate those waters in a healthy way so that they can keep their relationships together.
All right. So making the actual connection, creating financial intimacy, there's a process to it, and you break it down. You've got 8 archetypes of distinct personality types and their relationship with money. Now, I took your little test in the book and determined that, first and foremost, I'm the warrior type, which I hope is a good thing, but I got a little bit of the martyr type in me, too. So who am I compatible with?
The martyr is the tendency to want to rescue, take care of, and not necessarily have boundaries around money and people that you love. So you would be probably really well suited, first of all, to have another warrior partner who carries part of it so that you don't always feel the burden of all the responsibility. May I ask, was either of your parent also a martyr?
I would say, yeah. I mean, like a lot of people, I'm a child of divorce. And so I had a lot of negatives in my childhood that I then had to address growing up. And I think money is one of them.
Did you see either your mother or father suffer a lot relative to money growing up?
Not as much as I saw them suffering on some other fronts, but yeah, yeah. I mean, money is a thing. And as we correctly noted earlier, 50% divorce rate, money's a huge factor in that. And so the inability of people to communicate honestly and openly about money is a big issue. What are some basic meat and potatoes tips for improving financial intimacy?
It's so important to understand yourself relative to money. So you can do a lot of exercises to begin to just open the conversation and do some exploration. It's a worthy journey.
And then there's the whole putting on Barry White music and talking about muni bonds. The book is The Heart of Money, A Couple's Guide to Creating True Financial Intimacy. Deborah Price is CEO and founder of The Money Coaching Institute. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
All this talk of financial intimacy can stoke the fires of passion, and you'd think that Frenchmen wouldn't need much help in this department. But a recent proliferation of books, DVDs, and coaching sessions suggests that many French guys are looking for a little extra savoir-faire when it comes to affaires de la cour. And yes, I know my own high school French is catnip to the ladies. Our reporter John Lawrenson takes us to a Parisian seduction school.
A sunny afternoon outside the Pompidou Centre Art Museum. Nicolas breaks into a run. He and his coach have spied a target. Sparkly T-shirt at 2 o'clock.
Excuse me, I've just seen you and I think that with that T-shirt with sequins on, you must be a gold digger or something. Your style is really not bad.
Thank you, that's kind.
In fact, I would have loved to talk to you. I really like your little smile as well. Unfortunately, I have to meet some friends. But if you'd like, you and me, we can exchange phone numbers.
That's kind, but I have a lover.
Listening in thanks to a discreet microphone clipped to Nicolas' shirt, coach Alex Roth shrugs. Rejection's okay, he says, toughens you up. He's been there himself. That's why he founded Lifestyle Conseil, one of a number of similar French counselling companies, 4 years ago.
When I was younger, I was kind of lonely. And one day I said, okay, I have to go out to make some friends, to have a girlfriend. So it was quite a hard job, but now I can help other men to do the same because I did the job before.
Voilà, donc effectivement, qu'il y ait une bonne rencontre dans la rue et un bon échange.
Hot tells a classroom of note-taking students a cautionary tale about the importance of good spelling when texting women. A week of seduction school costs $1,300 for seminars like this, field work, and at the end, a party to which all the girls that have given their phone numbers to these apprentice seducers are invited. If all goes well, they'll end up perpetuating a long French tradition of seduction.
Vous avez tort de lire avec le bout du nez. Vous avez de très très jolis yeux et ça va les abîmer.
You shouldn't read with the book so close to your face. You've got very, very pretty eyes. Flirting in Paris's Luxembourg Garden in the 1959 film Charlotte and Véronique. From books and plays like Dangerous Liaisons and Molière's Don Juan to the recent movie Heartbreaker, seduction has always loomed large in French culture. This was something French men were good at, but is it still true of the French today? Down in the Luxembourg Garden, I ask some present-day Charlottes and Véroniques to share their experiences. Here's one of them, Juliette Minot.
We were in on a boat, it was a club on a boat, and we just arrived, and a guy came and said, oh, you dance so well. And we were like, we just arrived, I mean, come on, you couldn't see us dancing or anything, so...
Yeah. That's nice. was that a bad experience or a good experience?
It's bad experience, because it would say that to any girl.
The consensus, seduction classes, French men could use them. But back outside the Pompidou Centre, they haven't done the trick yet for Nicolas. How many girls has he approached this afternoon? Everybody's lost count.
Excusez-moi. Je viens de te voir et franchement, je te trouve plutôt pas mal comme fille.
Possibly suffering from charm fatigue, he begins an umpteenth offensive with, excuse me, I think you're not bad looking. To which the young woman replies, oh yeah, how many out of 10? But despite these inauspicious beginnings...
On peut échanger nos coordonnées.
Sans problème.
Okay.
When he asks for her number, she replies, no problem. And when he comes back to receive his coach's congratulations, his smile, perhaps for the first time this afternoon, is a real one.
Comment tu t'appelles?
Nicolas.
Nicolas.
Toi?
Arvia.
Arvia.
In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Alors, c'est tout pour Marketplace Argent pour cette semaine. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org. You can also get in touch on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, what The Walking Dead can teach us about money.
Zombie films are using death or the undead, that boundary, as sort of the ultimate expression of feeling disconnected, feeling powerless, an expression of social alienation.
Marketplace Money is produced by Le Grand Fromage Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. A bientôt.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, working to provide the right test for the right treatment for cancer patients at vanderbilthealth.com, the promise of discovery.
This is APM.